We've talked on this show over the years about the commons, which are those things we as human beings or citizens hold in common, the things we share, the things we own together. Think of natural resources or the broadcast airwaves, the public square. Obviously, not all things that we might think we share or should share are free and available to all. How much of government is in fact of, by, and for the people, and how much is dominated by moneyed special interests? Or on a simpler level, how much of the Malibu shoreline is actually open to the public? With issues of the environment or public health, questions of the commons are front and center. But there are other areas as well. As I said, the airwaves, the internet, and now those titans of Wall Street that taxpayers own all or in part. Today's guest, David Bollier, has been thinking and writing about the commons for years. Here's a quote from his newest book, Viral Spiral. Quote, a world organized around centralized control, strict intellectual property rights, and hierarchies of credentialed experts is under siege. A radically different order of society based on open access, decentralized creativity, collaborative intelligence, and cheap and easy sharing is on the rise. A global brigade of techies, lawyers, artists, musicians, scientists, business people, innovators, and geeks of all stripes, he says, are dedicated to creating a digital republic committed to freedom and innovation. From free and open source software, Creative Commons licenses, Wikipedia, remix music, video mashups, peer production, open science, open education, open business, the world of digital media has spawned a new sharing economy that increasingly competes with the entrenched media giants. David Bollier explores the commons as a new paradigm of culture, politics, and economics. He does this as a journalist, an activist, a speaker, an author, but especially as editor of onthecommons.org, a leading source of news and commentary about commons-based policy, activism, politics. He's also a senior fellow at the Norman Lear Center at the USC Annenberg Center for Communications and co-founder of Public Knowledge, a Washington policy advocacy organization dedicated to protecting the information commons. His books include Silent Theft, The Private Plunder of Our Commonwealth, and Brand Name Bullies, The Quest to Own and Control Culture. His latest is Viral Spiral, How the Commoners Built a Digital Republic of Their Own. Now, we're going to talk Viral Spiral, but I'm also going to ask David to comment on the recent and upcoming bailouts from the perspective of citizens and the commons. In other words, rather than fearing socialism, my question is, what are we getting for our, quote, common contributions to giant corporations, and what should we be demanding? Finally, how do the financial collapse of the top-down economy and the simultaneous emergence of the shared digital commons fit together? Welcome again, David Bollier.
It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Great. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. So for years, as I said, you've been thinking and writing about the commons, and that's what we'll be talking about. But what was the path that got you to that point?
Well, I had spent many years in Washington working with various public interest groups, and I began to notice that there was really kind of a pattern that in one arena after another, the public's resources were being ripped off. The government was giving them away to industry. You know, the airwaves are given away to commercial broadcasters for free. The timber and minerals on public lands are given away at below market rates. The research and development for new drugs that the federal government, and that is we taxpayers sponsor, is given away to drug companies who then charge exorbitant prices for us to buy it as a proprietary product. So in one area after another, I saw this happening, which is what led me to write my book, Silent Theft, showing that, you know, there's enormous amounts of things that we own in common that we don't even recognize that we own in common. And the first step to protecting it is to be able to name that phenomena and then step up and devise new ways to protect it.
So how do you define the commons?
Well, the commons is anything that a community, however that community defines itself, decides it wants to control in a collective manner and manage for the long term and in an equitable fashion. And usually this is in distinction from managing it as a product of the market, which is bought and sold for the highest price. So there's lots of ways in which we can manage something as a commons. There's no single way.
Okay, so for people who maybe haven't thought about this one too much, Why is this commons, the issue surrounding the commons, why is it important?
Well, because it's a way that we can, first of all, have greater fairness, and second of all, we can have more stability and control over our lives. Many of the regions of the country or even nations that allied themselves to the global economy, once the tide goes out of money, they're left totally bereft. But for those localities that have greater control over their local resources, they have greater autonomy over their lives and are not as beholden to centralized institutions in Washington or Wall Street, for example.
Okay, let me ask kind of an evolutionary or historical question. In other words, it seems to me that when I read about the the commons in sort of early writings about them, it's the field that a bunch of sheep herders might share. And that's the famous story of the tragedy of the commons, which I'll allow you to relate because it really lays this out very clearly. And at that point, you know, a few people or the sovereign owned most things, and there were these things that the village people might share. So then we had kind of an increase with new forms of government and so on that led to this notion, at least, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, you know, we the people. And yet, over the 200-plus years of that U.S. government based in that principle, it's become less and less true because of the smart and clever ways of those with money.
Well, you sketched, of course, many centuries there, but you're absolutely right. In the medieval times or in the 17th, 18th century Britain, the commoners had access and use of many resources that they used for their subsistence. They, you know, there was wild game, there was timber, there was fruit, and so forth. And this was something that was very important to their livelihoods. But then the landed gentry decided they wanted to seize those common resources and put them into service in the market. There was a great demand for wool, and so sheep needed commons to graze on. So essentially, the commoners were dispossessed of resources that they needed to live on, and many of them had to go to cities to try to find jobs. And this ended up in the underworld that Dickens sketched in his novels. Essentially, that process, which is called enclosure, is the privatization and the turning into commodities of resources that we share in common. Well, this is kind of a metaphor for what has been happening in the United States in the past generation or two, where everything from the human genome to objects of culture are turned into private property and sold on the market, and then the rest of us don't have access to something that really is a basic legacy or a basic right of citizenship that we ought to be able to own and control ourselves.
Very good. So that brings us kind of to the point at which this new emergence of a commons mentality, although my guess is most people didn't think of it that way. And so if you can tell us a bit about that history that you trace in Viral Spiral of this emergence of an alternative shared, as you say, digital citizens, history-making citizens, what's that? How did it happen?
Well, in the past generation, as much of the online and computer world went proprietary, as things became products, some people said, no, wait a minute, I want these resources to remain in common. And the first example was software code, where this legendary hacker at MIT, Richard Stallman, created a license called the General Public License, which helps assure that all the code that a community of hackers produce will stay in the commons and won't be taken private. This is what allowed Linux, the operating system, to emerge. People were willing to contribute their code for free as volunteers because they knew that IBM or Oracle or HP, Hewlett-Packard, wouldn't be able to take that code private. And so that's what allowed open source software to emerge so that you could have shared code. Well, flash forward to the year 2000, 2001, Professor Lawrence Lessig at Stanford University and a number of other lawyers and artists and computer programmers devised what are called the Creative Commons licenses. And these are licenses that, as a copyright owner, you can put on your work to signal this can be shared for free, and you can use it however you want. And this is a way of legally allowing people on the Internet to create pools of information and photos and music that can be legally shared. If you, for example, go to Flickr, there's 75 million photos that have Creative Commons licenses. So the licenses are a tool by which people can come together and create shared resources online, and this is creating whole new bodies of culture, creativity, music, film, video, that are starting to compete with the marketplace and mainstream media as they find that the blogosphere or Wikipedia or Flickr or the Internet Archive are bodies of information and tools that are actually more, they're cheap, they're free, and sometimes higher quality than what you can purchase on the market. So you have a whole new common sector and sharing economy that's emerging.
Okay, so it happened out there. Why do you need a Creative Commons license? Is something automatically seeming to be controlled and you have to tell people that it's not?
Well, one of the it goes back to copyright law, and in 1976 they did a major revision of copyright law, and it used to be that you had to register your work to make it copyrighted, and everything else was presumptively in the public domain, which could be used by anyone for free without permission. But in this law, everything was changed so that it was born copyrighted. So any little scribble on a piece of paper is going to be protected for your lifetime plus 70 years, because that's presumably the amount of monopoly protection you need to have an incentive to create new works. So, you know, obviously this is catering towards the major copyright industries that want to lock up their works as long as possible. But when the digital revolution came along and computers came along, where virtually everything is a copy and shared, when you download a website or look at a website, you're making a copy, this created enormous problems because everything is legally private property, and there's no easy way to, with confidence, share something without violating the law.
Uh-huh. So if I don't Creative Commons it is copyrighted?
Legally, virtually everything you're looking at on the web is private property.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people look the other way, or it's convenient for them to treat it as an open resource. But if you were to use it for any lucrative purpose, commercial purpose, you could be sued. And
mm-hmm.
So there's no way you could build a business around sharing it. And if you wanted to use it for certain purposes, you just might get sued, and some people do.
How big is the Creative Commons at this point in terms of how many things are licensed, get licensed, that sort of thing?
There's now an estimated 150 million web artifacts that have Creative Commons licenses, and the licenses themselves have been adapted to the legal jurisdictions of more than 50 countries around the world, and another 20 are in the process of doing it. So it's actually a rather large international movement.
Okay, so you actually, you know, the subtitle of your book, David, is How the Commoners Built a Digital Republic of Their Own. So that sounds like they've done it already. And to what extent do you really believe that we have built this digital republic?
Well, I think it's still a work in progress, but there are some significant infrastructure that's been built. The software code. There's, you know, literally thousands of different free and open source software programs that can't be taken private, and that's a very useful infrastructure. And then there are all these sites that have content that's protected by the licenses, the Creative Commons licenses, and that use free or open source software. So you know, you have these major flagships like Wikipedia and Flickr, the photo sharing site, and the Internet Archive, a huge repository, and many others, many smaller ones that we've never heard of or that serve only niche communities like Flu Wiki or Wiki Travel, which is a travel guide for users, many, many others. I think it's a significant cultural sector that really hasn't been fully acknowledged, but of course there's much more to be done, and it's a still evolving process, which is why I use the word spiral. It's like a viral spiral that's constantly building upon the achievements of prior cohorts of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to get to that title, viral, because it spreads, things can spread like a virus?
Yes, And it sort of, you know, borrows from the medical term, and it's like an almost magical process of diffusion and copying of things. And Spiral is how one generation of Internet innovators build the platform for a later generation and a later and a later. The free software innovation that Richard Stallman produced was the direct inspiration for the Creative Commons licenses, and the licenses in turn allowed many of these websites to develop and grow because they had protectable content. And then, you know, we have further generations of social networking and beyond. It's unclear where all this is going to go, but it is a robust and persistent and legally protectable sector of the non-market economy.
Just quickly, how does all of this pertain also to patent law? We've talked about copyright, which are these cultural artifacts. Where does patent law fit into this, and what has its movement been, and is there a similar free movement?
Well, software is more affected by patents than most cultural content, which is copyrighted. And there is an effort within the free software community to fend off the persistent challenges to expand the scope of patent law and try to disable or neutralize the power of free software. There's a new, a fairly recent group that was started by as an offshoot of a number of free software champions. I believe it's called the Free Software Center, or Eben Moglen, a professor at Columbia University, is behind it. But that's another front, and it's been going on even among certain business people who object to the broad scope that patent law has taken in recent years, where the classic case is where Amazon got a patent for one-click shopping. You know, and it's kind of, it sounds insane, but essentially there were business methods, so-called business method patents, that were essentially seizing rather simple default ways of doing things and claiming it as a private property right. And it, of course, that has terribly bad implications for future innovation. It's as if you were owning letters of the alphabet and you were able to charge any time somebody was making a word. So that's a very important front in trying.
Yeah, well, a friend of mine, Ian Chan Hodges out in Hawaii, has a group called Ingenuity something, which basically also sees it in terms of other things, in terms of new energy filters, any new technologies that the current patent law, or the patent law that was up for passage in the last Congress, definitely favored, like big pharmaceutical companies and big corporations over the little inventor. And sees another front on that in this, which
that's absolutely the case. And it's a matter of getting the right balance, because certain innovations that require a lot of capital to build do need patent protection. There's no question about that. But it's a matter of how far that goes and how much it shuts down competition and how much it shuts down future innovators.
Exactly. Yeah, it's interesting to go back to Tom Jefferson, who I think was one of the main of the founding fathers who wrote about this sort of thing, being he and Franklin being sort of inventors themselves, had interesting takes on this. You talk about, quote, digital citizenship, but then you also talk about, you then add on to that, history-making citizenship. I'm Terry McNally speaking with David Bollier about his new book, Viral Spiral. What we're talking about is the emergence of sort of a freer shared society than the corporately controlled one, arising mostly out of the digital world. So what do you mean by digital citizenship? Boom. Then what do you mean by history-making citizenship?
Well, I think the digital platforms that we've been talking about enable a radically new and direct form of citizenship that we haven't seen before. I mean, historically, if you want to go back to the beginning of the Republic, at first it was the land of gentry, and you were merely assenting to what they decided. And then in the 19th century, it became more a matter of political parties being the chief actors, and you allied yourself as a citizen with them. In the 20th century, it was more about becoming an informed, educated voter, and choosing intelligently, and voting was basically the chief act of a citizen. Well, in the digital republic that's now emerging, people can come together as an affinity group around a shared topic and directly intervene in politics in their own voice, with their own agenda, and you don't have to work through a political party, you don't have to work through the mainstream commercial press, and you can set things on the agenda and make them move. There's all sorts of examples of this happening, and I think I call it history-making citizenship, because it's not merely a matter of participating in someone else's institutional agenda. It's a matter of the commoners deciding what their interests are directly and passionately advocating it themselves.
Now, people describe the 2008 election, certainly the presidential election, as history-making. What role do you think digital citizenship played?
Well, a significant one. I think you saw the precursors in the Howard Dean presidential campaign, where social media was being discovered really for the first time on a big scale through that campaign. And then you saw it in the Ron Paul campaign in 2008, and I guess 2 years before that in the Ned Lamont challenge to Senator Lieberman. But the Obama campaign was a phenomenal explosion of user, voter, citizen-generated campaigning. It wasn't centrally directed, although there was loose coordination. That was sort of an example that of the citizen-directed energies which allied itself with the candidate. It will be interesting to see how Obama supporters independently express themselves apart from the president's policies.
Right, because right now the president's, if you're on that email list, you get emails saying, you know, support this thing that we're doing and support this thing that we're doing and hold a house party to support this thing we're doing. And while they have, I noticed that there have been reactions on the president's websites that probably he hadn't planned, but it still hasn't quite shown itself as a counterforce. Let me finally move to what I said I would ask you about at the top. I'd like you to comment on the recent and upcoming bailouts. Where does the sense of the commons, us as citizens, come into play when taxpayers are buying into corporations to save those too big to fail? Those you talk to and those you know that you've been in this community for 10 years, what's the sense about this?
Well, this is a classic case of the private sector, so-called, extorting the public for money. In this case, too big to fail, because the consequences not only for the company but for the rest of the economy globally are too disastrous to contemplate, and so they're able to extort money from us. And then basically say, if we try to attach conditions, which actually our compromised politicians ineptly failed to do, they can just sort of say, well, go take a hike. So we're seeing this rather dramatic brinksmanship confrontation between the surrogates for the public, our elected officials, and the private corporate world. It's for the most part, our elected representatives have been more in bed with the private sector because so much of their lives is benefited by campaign contributions and junkets and so forth. But the challenge is for we, the taxpayers, we, the commoners, to be able to have some control over our own tax money and get value for how it's spent. And it's really questionable whether we're getting true value.
But I would say that I do think a sense of the commons, a sense of us as in this together, has certainly emerged in the financial meltdown and the response to it. I think there's something going on that's changing who people identify themselves as and so on. Finally, let me ask this last question. The collapse of the enormously unequal top-down financial economy is happening at the same time as this emergence of a shared digital commons. Both are computer-driven. Both are globally networked and wouldn't be possible without that global networking, you know, capacity. How do they fit together, and how do they fit together going forward?
Well, I think they're actually interdependent and need each other. They're both different ways of creating value. One does it through money and contracts and selling. The other does it through communities of collaboration and social trust. And historically, however, the market economy has not really recognized the value that the commons provides to itself in developing new ideas and that it then commercializes. So much of the challenge ahead, I think, is getting a better equilibrium between the two and devising better mechanisms to protect the value that occurs in the commons.
Okay, got to end it there. I've been speaking with David Bollier. The book is Viral Spiral. The websites are viralspiral.cc, bollier.org, onthecommons.org. My email is T.E. McNally, one word, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y at mac.com.